Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys. Like the Samsung Stainless Steel Side-by-Side Refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser. Today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See store for details, valid through April 17th.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about common questions women have, patients have, I should say, when they're getting ready to do IVF or when they're in the middle of IVF. So common questions about IVF. We at Creating a Family get a lot of these questions, and so today we're going to answer some of them. I think you're going to really enjoy this show. This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport, who is a little hoarse today, and I'm your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a free program they want you to know about. It's called My Fertility Navigator. Navigator programs are becoming more common now, I think, in a lot of different fields, because what they do is provide one-on-one personalized support. And in this case, it's support for women who are struggling to get pregnant and are unsure of their next step. Once you enroll in the program, My Fertility Navigator, you receive personalized guidance from a live, dedicated My Fertility Navigator who can provide important information about fertility and infertility and provide you a list of nearby fertility centers and information on financing and how to afford infertility treatment, as well as talking about some of the fertility treatment options that are available. You can get more information at their website, myfertilitynav.com, myfertilitynav.com. Today, we're going to be talking about common questions people have with infertility. Before we talk about the show and an intro to the show, I want to tell you that this show and all of the resources that we provide here at Creating a Family, and we do provide a lot of them, could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners. And these are organizations that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information and support to the patient community. One such partner is Shrath 2.0. They are a specialty fertility pharmacy that believes pharmacy care can and should be remarkable. All the employees, literally all the employees, from the pharmacist down to the shipping coordinator, understand the stress of fertility treatment and are trained to treat customers with dignity, empathy, and respect. Another one of our wonderful partners is Fairfax Cryobank. They are a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years, and they are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Today, we're going to be talking with a doctor who's been on the show a number of times, Dr. Desiree McCarthy Keith. She is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with Georgia Reproductive Specialists and a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Morehouse School of Medicine. We're going to be talking about IVF, of course, but the questions that we get, questions, and this one we don't get so much anymore, but we used to get a lot, was day 3 versus day 5. What we get more now is fresh versus frozen transfers. What makes a good embryo? How do embryologists and reproductive endocrinologists even know what a good embryo is? And what are we doing, and what are some of the latest advancements for making really high-quality embryos? Anyway, so we're going to be talking about all of these topics, kind of a list of the questions that we get and answers to them with Dr. McCarthy Keith. This is a re-air of a show we did a couple of years ago with Dr. McCarthy, Keith. It was a popular show then, and I think you're going to enjoy it now.
Welcome, Dr. McCarthy, Keith, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you, Dawn.
Yeah. This is a topic that we hear, well, let's put it back. We get a lot of talk, of course, we have a huge online community, and we get a lot of talk about all aspects of the IVF cycle, as you would imagine. But there seems to be a great deal of confusion about the timing of the transfer of the embryos, as well as whether it's better to utilize fresh or frozen embryos. There just seems to be a fair amount of confusion, and I think that reflects the fact that the medical profession has been shifting in this. And research is coming in to indicate when and when the shift should occur. But I think we need to start with something pretty basic, because this is a show that's going to attract people. We kind of call them our basics or our 101 type shows, and we anticipate that this will be one of those shows. So I want to make certain that everyone who's listening knows what we mean when we're talking about timing of transfer, day 3, day 5. So can you give us a brief refresher on, for anybody who's not well-grounded in the IVF process, a kind of a short and sweet summary of what IVF entails?
Sure. So IVF and all of our fertility treatments are really based on the egg reserve or the function of the woman's ovaries naturally. So we always start out establishing that she has healthy reserve for those treatments, and then we take advantage of that. The woman administers daily injections. They're subcutaneous, or right under the skin of the abdomen or thigh, injections of hormones that will stimulate multiple eggs to develop. In a natural cycle, one egg develops. With IVF, we want many eggs to develop at one time, so we have more to work with in the lab. Average timing for those shots is about 10 to 12 days of daily injections, during which the woman is coming into the office for ultrasound and blood work monitoring to monitor if follicles are developing. After follicles have developed, woman is placed under anesthesia, and the eggs are extracted from the ovaries with a needle that goes through the vagina and punctures the ovary, and we extract each of those eggs. That procedure takes about 10 or 15 minutes. We take the eggs into our laboratory, and that's where we combine them with sperm, and then we monitor them as they develop in our incubators and go through the stages of embryo development. Once the embryos are developed, what we're talking about today is what do we do, when do we transfer, and can we freeze embryos or test? Are there things that we can do once we get to the end of that process?
And it used to be that it was pretty standard for embryos to be transferred from the petri dish to the woman's uterus at around day 3 of growth. And that transfer is a very simple procedure. As I understand it, it is simply a catheter inserted into the woman's vagina and through the cervix into the uterus, and the embryos are placed there. Am I correct first on that? Let me ask that question before you talk to me about the day 3 part.
Absolutely, that's correct.
Okay, so it's a of all the things you're going through with IVF, that's a office visit, but not a particularly strenuous one. So
right,
it used
and there's
to be,
no anesthesia. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, as opposed to with egg retrieval, there is anesthesia.
Exactly.
But with the transfer, it's a very simple process. Or at least from the outside, I realize that from a doctor's standpoint, it might be more involved. So it used to be that embryos were usually transferred on day 3 of growth. But now that transfer more often takes place at day 5. First of all, tell us the difference between day 3 embryo and a day 5 embryo. It's only 2 days, so, you know, it doesn't seem like that big a deal, right?
Well, there's a lot of development that happens in those 2 days, and we've been doing IVF treatments for over 30 years, so techniques in the lab have definitely improved, and it's allowed us to culture embryos further. But yes, traditionally, when IVF was started, we transferred embryos earlier because we were new at monitoring how embryos developed and how to culture and keep them viable and vigorous until we could transfer them back to the uterus. So from the day of an egg retrieval, when that single egg cell gets fertilized, that single egg cell will begin to divide, and the cell number will double over a couple of days. So as those cells divide, when you look at a day 3 embryo, there's usually going to be at least 6 to 8 separate cells in a little cluster. Those cells will continue to divide, and then they start to merge together into a blastocyst, which is a day 5 embryo. By day 5, the cells have kind of unified into an inner cell mass that will develop into the baby. The cells that will later become the placenta start to develop, and you have a much higher cell number and a more advanced embryo on day 5 than you do on day 3.
Okay, and why has there been the shift to to day 5 versus which is a blastocyst, so many hundred cell embryo, versus day 6, which is a 10 or under type cell embryo?
Again, we can get a lot more information from a day 5 embryo. When you have a day 3 embryo, we can see that it may be developing healthy at that point, but some of those embryos may slow down. They may not even make it to a blastocyst stage. So by culturing to day 5, if we are able, the embryos can kind of select themselves out as the ones that are more likely to make it to the blastocyst stage and be a healthy embryo. Also, when it comes to testing an embryo, we have more cells to work with on a day 5 embryo than a day 3.
Okay, we're going to come back to the genetic testing. Okay.
Yes.
So is it kind of like the survival of the fittest thing where we've got, the embryos that are the strongest and the most likely to implant and grow into a baby are the ones that would make it to day 5? Is that the thinking behind that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we see that in the lab.
You can see those that seem to be the replica or dividing quickly and on schedule are the ones,
exactly.
And those who arrest are going to arrest, and they're just not dividing as well. Okay.
Exactly. And so those are ones that may not even make it to day 5, and if we wait, then we can select from the better crop if we have enough embryos that are developing well.
Okay. It seems to me like it just in theory that we would want IVF to as closely as possible mimic what happens in a natural conception cycle. And as I understand it, the egg is fertilizes in the ovary, is released, sperm comes in through the vagina, up through the fallopian tube. At some point in the fallopian tube or thereabouts, it fertilizes, the egg fertilizes. In the egg slowly but surely makes its way into the uterus. And then hopefully implantation occurs then. At what stage in nature, outside of the lab, in a natural cycle, without infertility treatment, at what stage is the embryo when it leaves the fallopian tubes and arrives into the uterus?
So by the time the embryo reaches back to the uterus, it is a blastocyst. So the egg is ovulated and gets picked up by the end of the fallopian tube, and the sperm travel down to the egg at the end of the tube, and that's where the fertilization happens. And then over the next 5 or 6 days is where that embryo development happens in the fallopian tube. So the embryo is developing and slowly migrating back through the tube towards the uterine cavity, and it's really by about day 6 that an embryo will reach the uterine cavity and be ready to implant.
Okay, that's interesting. So really, about if we were looking at a natural cycle, the embryo, when it arrives in the uterus and for implantation, is around day 6. So, in essence, day 5 more closely mimics that.
It does. And it's really about the timing of the embryo's development, the timing of the development of the endometrium that is most important. So with a day 3 transfer, that is not an embryo that's going to divide and implant, as soon as you put it back. It still has to develop into a blastocyst and then progress to the implantation. So that will still take place at around the same window of time.
Why wouldn't we transfer on day 6 then? If ultimately a day 6 embryo is a better mimic of what happens in nature, why not transfer at day 6?
Sometimes we do. That's not the standard, but it really depends on how the embryos are developing in the lab. And again, with the experience of embryologists, and we do very fine manipulation of culture media so that it mimics the natural environment in the fallopian tube with the different nutrients and the oxygen levels and things like that are very important to how the embryo is developing. And so we've been able to study that environment in the lab and mimic as closely as we can to the normal process that's in the tubes. And at this point, it looks like the day 5 embryo, when it's at that blastocyst stage, is still going to be ready for implantation at the same time. Sometimes if we see embryos that are developing a little bit more slowly, almost a blastocyst, we do culture to day 6 and can freeze an embryo on day 6, and then those are also suitable for transfer.
Yeah, you know, the whole idea of the medium that we use to grow the embryos is fascinating to me. Because, of course, as you pointed out, we would like for that medium to as closely reflect what's happening in the fallopian tubes, but we know that it's not going to be the same. We know that nothing in the lab is going to be as good, for most embryos anyway, as being inside the woman. So what are some of the advances that are happening now with something as I guess in so many ways it sounds boring, but I can't think of anything more important than the medium, the in vitro medium that we're using. Have there been any changes, any major advancements in the last, whatever, X number of years?
The main thing is really just mimicking, and the levels of different nutrients are different at different levels or portions as you move through the tube. So most IVF labs are producing their own media, they're making it themselves, and really focusing on the glucose levels in the media, the lactate, and there are other nutrients that have to be there in order for it to be the best environment for the embryo to survive. So I think that in the past couple of years, as we've worked on the media formulations, that is what has allowed us to culture longer in the lab and to be able to observe embryos that are developing healthy to the blastocyst stage, where we can really select out, because that lab environment has improved so much beyond where we were culturing to day two or three, and then going ahead and transferring embryos without feeling comfortable that they would continue to thrive in the incubator.
I'm so glad you raised that about the importance of an embryology lab. I the more I learn and the more I know about infertility treatment, the more respect I have for the importance of the embryology lab. It's one of the things that we stress. In fact, the multimedia guide that I mentioned at the beginning on how to choose an infertility clinic, part of that is what questions to ask. How do you know what is a good lab? And this is a great example of why, you know, all clinics are not the same, and that is, you know, a lab matters, and because they're the ones who, I did not realize actually that they were, I thought it was a commercial product. I didn't realize that they were creating their own. That's interesting to me.
Absolutely. The lab is crucial to everything that we do. And so you definitely want embryologists in a lab that are experienced and have been working with embryos and doing lab procedures, whether it's ICSI or embryo biopsy or just culture, and have been doing that for a long time to get the best results.
Absolutely. So ultimately, what we care most about is the live birth rate. So, and I'm sure that there has been a great deal of research on whether day three transfers or day five transfers result in a higher live birth rate. What do we know?
I think that in general, there may be a trend towards lower live birth rates or pregnancy rates with a day three transfer versus a day five. But it's not really a reflection of the timing of the transfer. What we have to consider is that a patient who's having a day three transfer, especially at this point in time where we are more advanced in the lab, those are more likely to be embryos that were developing more slowly, or we had fewer embryos to work with, or we were concerned that those embryos may not make it to day five. So I think that if you look at it from, this was probably, you know, a lower prognostic group from the beginning if they were transferred early versus patients who had embryos developing well, or they had several that were making their marks, then the pregnancy rates would be higher for those that had more favorable embryos versus, you know, less favorable that got transferred earlier.
So is it something, it's almost the thought process that it looks like none of these are going to make it to day five, so we might as well transfer at day three, because if there's any chance, you know, we'll, you know, roll the dice and see if that's going to, you know, if any of them will implant. Is that the kind of the thought process that you have to go through?
Yes, sometimes there is concern, and particularly if we have just a few embryos that are developing, say a patient has one or two embryos that are developing on day two and three, then there's, you know, the conversation is there any benefit to going to day five? It's not going to change. If we have two on day three, they're going to be the same two on day five. Should we transfer them early, or should we let them develop and see which of those make it to day five? But if you have a limited number of embryos, then sometimes that's a consideration to go ahead and transfer and get them into the uterine environment sooner because you're not trying to weed out a larger pool of embryos to get to the best ones. You have what you have. And then also just the development and the quality of those embryos may be ones where we don't want to risk pushing to day five and just losing those embryos before a transfer.
Is it possible to transfer into the fallopian tube, if that's where in nature the embryo normally develops? Is it possible to get the embryo to that place and allow that environment to help culture it and grow it?
There were earlier treatments where you could transfer either eggs and sperm, or you could transfer an embryo to the tube, and those are not performed anymore. There were more issues. It's a more involved procedure to manipulate the tube and to actually place an embryo there, as opposed to just doing a brief outpatient procedure where you can place an embryo in the uterus. And also some concerns about those embryos then not migrating back through the tube and getting to the uterus normally. So that's not something that's done anymore. It's called ZIFT or GIFT.
Which is where you place
a zygote or embryo in the tube.
And they were the concern was, at least one of the concerns was ectopic pregnancy, where the embryos were more likely to implant into the fallopian tube, which is not where they're supposed to implant. Okay.
Exactly.
We have a question from Caroline that is associated with what you were just talking about, the quality of embryos. Caroline says, I'm confused about embryo grading and how that changes the day of transfer, if it even does. So let's talk about embryo grading in general. Caroline, I think, knows what that means. Can you talk to us about what grades, how do we grade embryos and what does that mean?
Yes. So SART, our infertility organization, has made efforts to streamline and kind of standardize that process more recently. Used to be that different clinics graded their embryos with different types of categories and criteria. So now we've got a more standardized approach where embryos are graded A, B, C, or good, fair, and poor on day three and on day five. The grading on a day three embryo, again, when you're looking at a day three embryo, you're looking for at least 6 to 8 cells in the embryo. You want to see symmetry between those cells, so you don't want a large cell and then a few small ones. You're looking at the degree of fragmentation or cellular debris that's around the embryo. And so a grade A best quality embryo is going to have good cell number, symmetric cells, and minimal to no fragmentation. And then depending on the degrees of those factors is going to lead you to a fair or a poor quality embryo. A day five embryo, blastocyst looks completely different. So at that point, you should have a well-identified inner cell mass, which is a separate little cluster of cells that will develop into the fetus. You'll have a scalloped appearance to the edge of the embryo, and those are the trophectoderm cells, which become a placenta. So you want to see a well-defined inner cell mass. You want to see good trophectoderm, and you look for those type of features in a day five embryo to determine if it's a good, fair, or poor grade embryo.
A couple of years ago at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine Conference, ASRM, which was just a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about videoing the embryo development to see the, as I understood it, the rapidity of the development, and that was a good indicator of a quality embryo. What is the research currently showing us on that?
There is still interest in that. I think the larger issue and why that's not done more available at this point is because of the cost of changing lab structures and bringing in new and expensive equipment that can, monitor embryo development in real time. So there are research studies showing that by doing that video monitoring of the speed that the embryo develops and the cleavage that goes on, that gives more information than just taking a snapshot on day three and then coming back a few days later and taking a look, but seeing how that progress is made throughout the embryo development. I think that's something that's probably coming in the future, but will take some time to adopt just as the research comes out and as people are able to really add that new technology to their lab and the expense of doing that.
And ultimately, are they? Does it add? Is the research showing that it adds information that really isn't available, though, from a single snapshot or a single day assessment made at day three or day five? Is it worth the? Is the research indicating that it's worth the procedure to video monitor?
I think at this point, probably not worth the, you know, overhaul of your lab to add that in, because we are comfortable with how we're monitoring. But as we just make new advances in all areas of infertility, I think that it's something that will be added to the treatments. But I can't say that right now. The research says if you put a video in, you're going to have better pregnancy rates and you're going to see all your embryos, and that it's going to make that kind of impact right off the bat. But as that improves, I think that that will give us another marker for how we can assess the embryos as they're developing in the lab.
Yeah, just as progress is, and as more research comes in, and you know, indicating whether or
exactly.
not it's, yeah. You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about IVF transfers, fresh versus frozen, 3-day versus 5-day. Our guest is Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith. We would love to have you join us on our social networks. Clout, the online ranker, now ranks us as, I think this last week we were number 2 online influencer in the world for fertility. They rank fertility, not infertility, but still. We hang out on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and we would love to have you join us. On Facebook, there are 3 ways to connect with us. You can join with me personally. I'm dawn.davenport1. You can also like our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/creatingafamily, or you can join our online support group. We are over 7,000 members strong now, and you can find that at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, or to be honest, the easiest way is just to type in Creating a Family in the Facebook search box. You can like the page and join the group. It's very easy. It is a closed group, so you will have to be approved, but we do that at least once a week. On Twitter and Pinterest, we're easier because we go by one thing, and that is @creatingafamily, so you can find us there then. So please join us. We would really love to have you. Dr. McCarthy-Keith, there have been some fascinating research in the last several years on the benefits of frozen embryo versus fresh embryo IVF transfers. Can you explain that to us? Because it really does fly in the face of what intuitively we would think. Because intuitively, we were thinking that it's better if something is fresh and not frozen, because that's certainly how it is with other things in our lives, our foods and things such as that. And so it makes sense that it would be the same with embryos. But maybe it's not. So tell us what the research is showing.
So the big change between fresh and frozen, again, is that we're learning more about trying to make the uterine environment as close to natural as possible. And for some patients who are very hyperstimulated or overstimulated in their IVF cycle, their hormone levels may be higher, and that may not be the best environment to transfer an embryo fresh. Even though the embryo is developing well and looks vigorous and healthy, it's not as close to the physiologic environment as if we were to freeze an embryo and come back with less stimulation, or do a natural cycle even where the hormone levels are closer to a natural menstrual cycle, and that way the embryo is transferred into a more normal environment. So that's one factor related to maybe why sometimes we don't transfer fresh, because we want it to be closer to natural. The other issue that I think we're going to get to is that many of the embryos that are frozen are actually biopsied and tested. So there's another layer of information that we're getting on these frozen embryos that can increase the chance of an implant and leading to a baby, other than just it being a frozen versus a fresh embryo.
Yeah, we are going to get to that. You're exactly right. You mentioned a natural cycle, and I'm assuming that that means a cycle where no medications are given to the woman to help stimulate her uterine lining or the development of the uterine lining. Is that what you mean by a natural cycle?
Correct.
So you have a choice with a frozen embryo transfer, then it sounds like, to either have, and I think this would probably depend upon the woman's diagnosis, but to either just allow her body to develop the uterine lining through her natural cycle as it would happen, or taking medication. What are the advantages to each, whether to medicate or non-medicate, in order to stimulate the uterine lining?
So for many patients, when it comes to doing IVF and even frozen embryo transfers, timing is very important. Timing of the lab, their culture media, the lab schedule. Most clinics are going to kind of bring patients through in groups or batch their cycle so that things are performed most efficiently in the lab and the best use of resources and media and things like that. So the timing of a natural cycle can be challenging, where you have to basically go with a woman's cycle. And depending on when she starts her cycle or when she's close to ovulating, you have to be prepared to do a transfer at that point. So it can be a challenge, and that's probably the main reason that natural cycles are not performed more often, is just because of the technical challenges of doing that. However, if a woman does have a natural cycle, I've seen patients who attempted medicated cycles and they didn't tolerate the medicines very well, or they ovulated prematurely despite being on certain medications to suppress the ovaries or things like that, and then they've gone back and done a natural cycle where we just kind of let her natural ovarian function happen, monitor the endometrium, and really just overlap the transfer with how her normal cycle is progressing. And I've seen good results with that. I think that the timing is probably the biggest challenge. And also, you have to monitor patients more closely in a natural cycle, since we're not giving meds to suppress ovulation or have the control to really manipulate or prolong the cycle. There's greater potential to possibly miss an ovulation if she has an irregular cycle. You know, if we're kind of waiting on her to do it on her own, sometimes she can progress outside of our expectations, and that may be a limitation in performing that way also. On the flip side, a medicated cycle does allow us to really suppress the ovaries, to give the estrogen, get it to a level where we want it to be before we do an implantation. We can time the progesterone exposure of the endometrium before we put an embryo back. So we can really just manipulate the cycle and really know the details a lot better in a medicated cycle, and we can control that a lot better when we start out that way from the beginning.
I haven't seen much research on this, and that probably is because I haven't seen it, not that it doesn't exist, on live birth rates compared to natural cycles. I guess this would only be applicable to frozen embryo transfers versus medicated cycles. Do you know anything about any of the research that's currently being done or has been done recently?
I haven't seen any larger studies for that because, again, it's usually, you know, a fraction of the patients who are going through the natural cycles versus going through the medicated. Just in our experience here, though, I have seen patients who have had better experiences with a natural cycle, particularly if they have not done well with a medicated cycle, whether the tolerance or have not gotten pregnant with that. It really comes down to how well the uterus responds and how that endometrium develops. And there are so many factors related to, you know, the woman's whole picture of endometriosis or fibroids and different factors, uterine procedures, that really determines how successful we'll be with either of the methods, actually.
We hear a lot now, and I think this is good, we're hearing a lot about it, about the term window of implantation. That's a bit of a buzzword that's coming up a lot. Tell us what you mean by window of implantation.
So in a natural cycle, there is going to be, you know, a natural cycle is 28 to 30 days. And so the most likely time for a woman to ovulate if she's having regular 28-day cycles is going to be day 14 of her cycle. And so the window, if you're telling couples who are trying to conceive naturally, the window of their fertility is going to be, you know, a day or two before and a day or two after when you expect that ovulation to happen. And the window of implantation is really going to be within that 24 to 48 hours from the time of an ovulation until that embryo, you know, finds a place to implant. So it's a smaller window of time for the implantation to actually take place. And that's why we spend so much time with monitoring and timing the days of progesterone exposure before you transfer an embryo back to the uterus. That is a very critical window where you have to have synchronization between the endometrium and the embryo in order for them to implant. So healthy embryo is one step, but you really have to have the uterus that is ready and receptive for that implantation, and that's where the progesterone and that window come into place.
Gotcha. And that's the and that argues oftentimes, particularly as we're the embryos are developing in the lab separately from the woman's endometrial lining that is developing,
mm-hmm.
and so it's the timing of the two, and hence why some of the evidence is indicating a frozen embryo transfer might be preferable, because it's at that point you're only waiting on the development of the uterine lining, and so whenever it's ready, you're not having to wait on the embryo development, because that embryo is frozen and it can be thawed and transferred at that point. Do I understand
exactly.
that correctly? Yeah,
exactly. And so sometimes when we do a cycle, if the endometrium is developing a little bit more slowly, then we still have the option to continue with that stimulation and get the embryo to the stage, get the endometrium to the stage we want it to be before thawing and transferring an embryo. So it really does allow us to optimize and have the best environment before we thaw an embryo and transfer. And we know that synchronization is there.
Excellent. You are listening to Creating a Family, and we are talking with Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith about IVF transfers, fresh versus frozen, 3-day versus 5-day. I want to take a moment now to thank a few more of our wonderful gold sponsors and to remind you that it is only through their generous support that we are able to bring you this show. We have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to adoption and assisted reproductive law, including providing a gestational surrogacy matching program, as well as legal services, of course, for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation matters. We also have Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years and are dedicated to supplying updated, verified and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Only 1 in 200 applicants make it through their screening process to become a donor. All right, now you have been alluding to the whole role of genetic testing and how it might influence our decisions associated with when to transfer and whether to do fresh or frozen. And that is certainly probably one of the hottest topics, particularly in the medical community as well as in the patient community. So let's talk about genetic testing. It's genetic testing of the embryo. So we have to have a part of the embryo in order to test. So when can we get a cell, or and how many cells do we need in order to do this testing?
Okay, that's perfect. So, again, the evolution of IVF, we used to do embryo testing on day 3. And there were several concerns with testing a day 3 embryo. As I mentioned, on average, a day 3 embryo is going to be composed of 6 to 8 cells. And to biopsy an embryo on day 3 would require taking one of those cells away from the embryo. So you can reduce the volume of the embryo when you only have a few cells at that time to take a whole cell away. We also get less cells and less information when you're biopsying on day 3. Another concern with a day 3 biopsy was the concept of mosaicism, which is where if you take one cell away from that embryo and you get a diagnosis from that one cell, it may or may not represent the chromosomal content of the whole embryo, and you can get a negative result from that cell and discard an embryo that may have been normal, or vice versa. So now we are performing biopsies on day 5. Again, the embryo is more advanced. The cells have kind of merged together. We're able to get more cells with a day 5 biopsy. And so we feel that we get more cells, we can get better information, more reliable information. We're not reducing the volume of the embryo to the same degree. And we can get good information when we do an embryo biopsy at that stage as compared to day 3 without the concerns for the mosaicism of before.
So there is less mosaicism because you've got more cell mass to be and more cells to analyze. Is that the interpretation?
Exactly. And also, if you look at a day 3 embryo, they really are separate cells that are just kind of clustered together, almost like a cluster of grapes. And then by day 5, those cells really start to merge together, and the inner cell mass becomes pre-fetal tissue, and the trophectoderm is actually where the biopsy is performed. So we do not biopsy the cells that are going to develop into the fetus. This also allows us to biopsy cells that are distant from the cells that will develop into the embryo, so we're not reducing that volume. and we're getting more cohesive information about that whole embryo because we're getting more cells that have started to merge and to develop and divide.
Intuitively, that just makes such that just seems such a safer process. When you are taking, you've got at day three a 6 to 8 cell mass, and you're taking one of those. I mean,
exactly.
That's a significant reduction. What I mean, you probably are getting part of the cell that would have grown into the fetus, not into the placenta. So, what are you taking? I mean, what's the risk? Could you be taking something that could not be made up or could not be replicated? Are you going to cause birth defect as a result?
Well, we were early enough in the development that when you're doing a day three biopsy, the concern was more with the information that you're getting than the actual harm to the embryo, because those cells will continue to divide and to develop into a blastocyst. So not as likely for a day three biopsy to cause a birth defect or to cause a problem with how the embryo develops later, but it's more about, were we getting information from that biopsy that was really reliable and that we could share with our patients and help them to make a decision about that embryo.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so now we know that if possible, the choice is to do genetic testing at day five. So how does that influence when you transfer? You're also keeping in mind, we're also, the preferred day to transfer is day five. So that puts a lot happening on one day.
It does. And there are several labs throughout the country who perform the testing on the embryo biopsies. Depending on where your clinic is located, your testing facility may be in a different state, or it might take some time before you get those results back. So unless you have the capabilities to run that testing and get the turnaround in 24 hours, most clinics are biopsying embryos on day five, freezing the embryos at that point, sending the biopsy sample to their reference laboratory, and then waiting for that report to come back in a week or so. And at that point, you have very specific information about the chromosomal content of each embryo that was biopsied. And once you get that information, then you prepare for a frozen cycle once you get back the report of where the normal embryos are. So a fresh transfer after biopsy is usually not performed.
Okay, and unless you happen to have a lab either in your have a testing ability in your lab or live near one of the your clinic is near one of the testing and then even if it's in your let's say you have the capability of running the analysis of testing, the genetic testing in your own lab, you also then would have to make the decision of whether to transfer, one would think most logically on day six. I guess you could get it back if it was done first thing in the morning and come back in the afternoon. Is that how it's done, or do they then transfer on day six if they're wanting to do a fresh?
Usually at day six, you need to do biopsy very early on the morning of day five. And in some situations, you can get that turnaround time and get a biopsy result back in less than 24 hours. But majority of times it's going to be go ahead and biopsy and freeze. And then the other thing, as we always already mentioned, is that the environment of the fresh cycle may be a reason to not transfer a fresh, even if you can get the biopsy results back. If a patient's hormone levels, estrogen is very high, if her progesterone has elevated during her cycle, then those are reasons that you don't necessarily want to do a fresh transfer, even if you were able to do that. So we have to take all that into consideration.
Yeah, in other words, she might have peaked, her uterine lining might have peaked at day five, and then if you wait till day six, then you've missed the peak window of implantation.
Possibly, or that it was just not even the day five versus day six, but if she has estrogen level that's, 4,000, or she was hyperstimulated in her cycle where a fresh transfer would put her at further risk for hyperstimulation, or that you just are looking for a more natural environment with lower estrogen levels that you can really control, then that may be a reason to not do a fresh transfer, even if you can get that quick turnaround time.
So how long should the let's say you freeze, you make the decision that you're going to freeze the embryos and do a mm-hmm. frozen embryo transfer. Is there any evidence that says that you should give the woman's body a month or two to get back to normal before you do it, or should you do it the following month? Because at this point, everybody's anxious to find out if it's going to work.
Exactly. So it's usually recommended that you at least have 1 month between the stimulated cycle and then getting back to a more natural cycle for the transfer. And, you know, based on just the physiology of the cycle, it's really not possible to do a transfer any sooner than that, because after an egg retrieval, the hormone levels have to come down. The woman needs to have a menstrual withdrawal and shed that lining, and it takes some time to do that and then start to prepare the endometrium for a transfer. So it's usually a month minimum between a fresh cycle and getting to a frozen transfer anyway. But at least a month between those cycles is recommended.
Okay, so people need to realize that it does add a month or two onto the process if the option is made to do a freeze the embryos and transfer thawed embryos at a later date.
Exactly. And then if we're talking about embryo testing, patients have to be prepared for any result to come back from those biopsies. So ideally, we want to test embryos, identify the normals, and have those embryos available for transfer. But when we test, especially when we have certain higher risk groups that we really encourage the embryo testing in, there's always potential for us to have few or no normal embryos available once we do that testing. The first step of embryo grading is the morphology and how the embryo looks in the lab under the microscope. And so you can have embryos that look totally normal in their blastocyst development. And then when you biopsy, the chromosomes may be abnormal. And if we get to that point, then we have to talk about, you know, what we would do differently. So patients who we recommend have biopsy are women who are older, who are in the late 30s or over 40, where we know that egg quality is starting to change and more likely to have abnormal embryo development. Women who've had recurrent miscarriages that may be due to a chromosomal abnormality, or patients who have a genetic disease that there's risk of them passing on to their child if both parents carry a recessive gene and a child can inherit that. So those are the types of patients who we strongly encourage to have the embryo testing, and then we have to be prepared to handle whatever those results come back as.
So in other words, people may need time to assess and not with no pressure that they have to hurry and make a decision. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and also just that with more information, there come more complications sometimes. And so our goal is always go through IVF, get plenty of eggs, healthy embryos, and have a baby. But if we keep adding in steps of testing the embryos, culture them further in the lab, and now we're biopsying to see where they're healthy, there is a natural attrition that goes through that whole process where the follicles that we begin with in a cycle, each of those is not going to lead to a baby and a healthy embryo or healthy embryo and a baby at the end. So there's a drop-off along the way. And we counsel patients about that, and we have to be ready for, you know, any kind of results that can come back from those biopsy reports. I've seen all healthy embryos. I've seen where none of the embryos have been healthy. It's usually a mix of the two. But we have seen all results.
And what is the attrition rate now in cryopreservation? That is a concern that a lot of people have. I mean, if we can thaw as someone once told me, the trick is not in the freezing. The trick is in the thawing, getting embryos to thaw without damaging cells and things such as that. But the cryopreservation techniques have improved dramatically in the last, I guess, probably 10
exactly.
years or so. So
yes, and that's much
how much of a danger do we have?
I would say, first you say the trick is in the thawing. I would go a step back and say the trick is really in the quality of the embryo before it's frozen. So if an embryo is well-developed, if it's a healthy embryo, if it's genetically tested, those are embryos that are more likely to survive being vitrified and then thawed. And to lead on to a healthy implantation. On average, the chance of a embryo surviving being frozen and thawed is about 80 to 90%. So majority of embryos, if they are healthy when they're frozen, are going to do just fine through that process. But we do occasionally see where a healthy embryo does not re-expand or does not thaw well after that process.
You know, ultimately, I think most people going through IVF, their ultimate concern or worry is for the health of the children conceived. And has there been any long-term research comparing children who were conceived through either a day 3 or a day 5 transfer? And let me stop and say that it is very hard to get good research on long-term health impacts of IVF on the children. It's a source of frustration for, I think, for all of us. But given that there is not a great deal of research, what does the research show?
I am not aware of good studies that look at, you know, outcomes for day 3 versus day 5 as far as birth defects and things like that. What we do know is that we have seen an evolution of day 3 to day 5 with just the development of IVF in this country in the past 30 years, and there are large studies looking at children born from just IVF treatments in general, and
right.
It really looks like the risk of major birth defects is the same. It's about 2-4% whether children are born through natural conception or through going through fertility treatment. So overall, does not appear to be a greater increase of those birth defects and things, but I'm not aware of great studies that show a comparison between day 3 and day 5.
I'm not either. I was hoping maybe you knew one. What about any research on long-term research? Because ultimately, that's the most important type. We want to follow kids and see not just at the moment of birth, but how are they doing when they're 6, 7, 8, that type of thing. But is there any research on health of children conceived from either fresh or frozen IVF cycles? You could make my day if you say yes, there is some great research out there.
Sorry, Dawn. We don't have those kind of comparisons either. We just have the general look, but that may be something that's coming in the future to really get down into the specifics of fresh versus frozen, but I have not seen, you know, long-term studies on those outcomes either.
Yeah, I didn't either, and I actually went at the ASRM conference just a couple of weeks ago. I went to the poster presentations, and I didn't listen to all of them, but I did walk through and was hoping to find. I love the posters, so yeah. The mark of a true research geek is the one who goes to the posters. But I didn't see anything there, and I don't believe there was any presentations on it either. So this year's or last year's, for that matter. So.
Yeah.
Darn.
And I would guess that the bigger research in the posters that you'll see, if it's talking about fresh versus frozen, are really focusing on the genetics and the embryo biopsy. And that's where
yeah.
the focus is these days, on the delineation and not just the day of the transfer, or fresh or frozen.
Right, but that's not the question I would like to see answered, because, yeah, obviously the reason that you're doing that you're waiting, and if you're doing genetic testing, is because, so you would expect that the genetics of a child conceived through after genetic testing, you're going to have less chromosomal issues because you've tested for those.
True.
But, yeah, so the question to me, the more important question, or not more important, but a different question, is there, how are those children, if we were comparing them, doing into adolescence, or, you know, let's not be that may be a little too ambitious. Let's just say through 5 and 6, is there any difference for those children? And that research, I don't know if it's not being done, or it's not being done here in the U.S., I don't think, but we could always
And I think
hope.
That you, exactly, hopefully it's coming. One thing that I always reinforce with my patients, though, is that even if we do the testing and we confirm that the chromosomes are normal, that does not, a normal karyotype does not exclude, you know, structural growth problems or developmental
right.
issues and things like that. So that can still occur even though we have tested and we have assurance that the chromosomes and the embryo, you know, the chromosome count was normal. There can still be other issues that arise.
That is such a good point. It's an issue that needs to be made with genetic testing, because there is the, I think, the misconception sometime amongst the patient community that if their embryos have had genetic testing, that means that there is very low risk of, when there is very low risk, but that there is zero chance that anything can go wrong, and that just simply isn't the case.
Exactly. And we tell patients, you know, even if we test an embryo and we confirm it's normal, the risk of miscarriage does reduce, but it will never be zero. So for a natural conception or just average risk of miscarriage in the first trimester is usually about 15 to 20%, which is kind of high. If we test an embryo and confirm it's normal, the risk of miscarriage goes down to about 5 to 10%. So it's much lower, but it still is not, you know, excluded completely.
We have kind of a geeky question that I was debating on whether, I'm not sure, that it has a lot of general interest, but it has a great deal of interest to Lou, so we're going to ask it. And I'm not sure if Lou is a he or a she. Asking about the importance of air quality in the lab on embryo development, and are labs with better air quality better able to grow embryos to day five? So this is, yeah, this is a little more esoteric than our usual questions. Thoughts on air quality issues?
Absolutely. Any IVF lab that you visit, you will have to raise your voice as you walk through the lab, because there are very sophisticated ventilation and air quality and monitoring systems that have to be in place in order for embryos to have the best environment to develop in. So we know that air quality is very important, and that needs to be monitored, and you want you want the system to be filtered and to not have those kind of influences on the embryos. So that's a great question. And there's lots of, you know, fans and filters and things that have to be in place in order for that IVF lab to function.
You know, IVF labs are so darn cool. They are so interesting. They are. I just, and actually I've been in your lab, believe it or not. You would have no way of knowing this, but I was a long time ago, had gone into your lab and talked with Dr. Tucker, and I there are just, it's absolutely, I mean, what a cool job to be an embryologist. Think
I
about
agree.
It. I know. I just think it's so fascinating. Yeah, so questions on air quality just seem cool to me, but I'm not sure that that's a universally considered thought, but anyway, or felt thought. Let me thank you so much, Dr. McCarthy Keith, for being our guest today to talk about IVF transfer, all things IVF transfer. Let me take a moment to ask our listeners, this show, as well as everything we do at Creating a Family, exists because of the support from people just like you. So please take a moment and consider giving us a donation. It can be a small amount, $5 a month. It can be a recurring donation, or it could be a set donation. You can go to our website, creatingafamily.org, and you can find the button for donate there, and we would really appreciate it. I know that everybody is going to want to get more information about Dr. Desiree McCarthy Keith at Georgia Reproductive Specialist. So you can, to get more information, you can go to their website, which is the best IVF website around, and it is IVF.com. And you could get more information about Dr. McCarthy Keith there, or be able to ask questions. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Everything you're hearing is from the Home Depot, from the baseboards and nails to these throw pillows, even those super soft sheets. Because now at the Home Depot, you can get everything for your bedroom, from wooden nightstands to modern benches. Save up to 25% on select bedroom furniture, plus free and flexible delivery and easy in-store returns. Shop decor now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items, $45 or more. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.